Hello and welcome. I'm Nathan Eckersley, and on a special edition of the show this week, we are looking back on the biggest stories of 2022 and revisiting some of our most interesting and important interviews. We're featuring conversations with Ukrainian MP Sviatoslav Yurash, Conservative peer Baroness Morrissey, and comedian Konstantin Kissin. It's a packed show, so let's go. I think it's fair to say that 2022 has been a year like no other. Over the last few years, a number of momentous events have happened. However, 2022 has been truly historic, and it has been an immense privilege to cover these events on this show. None of it would be possible without you, listening live every week or downloading the podcast. So thank you for sticking with me and with us. 2023 is set to be just as lively, and I cannot wait to keep providing analysis and interviewing incredible people. The best is yet to come. Now, because so much has happened in 2022, I think it's best to begin by summing the year up in numbers. 2022 has seen one Platinum Jubilee, one war in Europe, two monarchs, three prime ministers, four chancellors of the Exchequer, four government reshuffles, five education secretaries, six fiscal events, six parliamentary by-elections, 14 MPs losing their parliamentary whip, 33 peerages conferred, and 147 government ministers resigned or sacked, of which 32 were at cabinet level. 2022 began with Boris Johnson's government fighting allegations on all fronts of large gatherings being held in government buildings during lockdown, with the initial findings of the famous report by senior civil servant Sue Gray being published. Partygate, as it became known, would dominate the headlines for the next 6 months and caused Bury South MP Christian Wakeford to defect from the Conservatives to Labour. Turmoil in the Conservative Party and fixed penalty notices being issued to the then Prime Minister and his Chancellor Rishi Sunak. The full Sue Gray report found 16 gatherings had taken place with widespread rule breaching by advisers and civil servants. Boris Johnson's domestic worries were put to one side in February, as rumours began to circulate of a Russian military escalation on the Donbass and other borders with Ukraine. Johnson made a mad dash around Europe, lobbying his counterparts to support and arm Ukraine in case of an invasion. He even flew to Kiev to meet with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky just 3 weeks before the Russian invasion. Sadly, on the 24th of February, Russian President Vladimir Putin gave the order for a nationwide invasion of Ukraine. For the first time since 1995, war had returned to Europe. The then Prime Minister was Ukraine's biggest asset and became the first foreign leader to visit Kiev following the outbreak of war. Johnson's efforts were reluctantly supported by US President Joe Biden and other NATO allies. So far, the war has tragically taken the lives of over 40,000 people, injured 53,000 people, and displaced more than 14 million. On the day the war began, the then Prime Minister gave this televised message to the British public.
Our mission is clear. Diplomatically, politically, economically, and eventually militarily, this hideous and barbaric venture of Vladimir Putin must end in failure. And so I say to the people of Russia, whose president has just authorized a tidal wave of violence against a fellow Slavic people, as the parents of Russian soldiers who will lose their lives, I cannot believe this is being done in your name, or that you really want the pariah status it will bring to the Putin regime. And I say to the Ukrainians in this moment of agony, we are with you. We're praying for you and your families, and we are on your side. And if the months ahead are grim and the flame of freedom burns low, I know that it will blaze bright again in Ukraine, because for all his bombs and tanks and missiles, I don't believe that the Russian dictator will ever subdue the national feeling of the Ukrainians and their passionate belief that their country should be free.
Despite receiving praise for his efforts overseas, domestic pressures became too much for a beleaguered Boris Johnson, as he became embroiled in one scandal too many. Allegations of sexual misconduct by Deputy Chief Whip Chris Pincher forced him to resign. However, it later transpired that Johnson knew about these allegations before promoting Pincher to that position. This was the straw that broke the camel's back and triggered a staggering 60 resignations from his government, ranging from the very lowest rungs of the ladder, with Conservative Party vice chairs, trade envoys, and parliamentary private secretaries, to the very top, with the Chancellor of the Exchequer and Secretary of State for Health and Social Care. After losing the confidence of the parliamentary party, Boris Johnson, the greatest survivor of modern British politics, resigned as Prime Minister and leader of the Conservative Party, triggering a two-month-long leadership election. The contest over the summer was deeply divisive and split the Conservative Party even further than it already was. Eight candidates went through to the MP's ballot, with Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak making it to the party members' ballot. 12 hustings were held across the country, with Liz Truss being elected leader with 81,326 votes to Sunak's 60,399. On her appointment as Prime Minister, this is what she said to the nation.
Now is the time to tackle the issues that are holding Britain back. We need to build roads, homes and broadband faster. We need more investment and great jobs in every town and city across our country. We need to reduce the burden on families and help people get on in life. I know that we have what it takes to tackle those challenges. Of course, it won't be easy, but we can do it. We will transform Britain into an aspiration nation with high-paying jobs, safe streets, and where everyone, everywhere, has the opportunities they deserve. I will take action this day and action every day to make it happen. United with our allies, we will stand up for freedom and democracy around the world, recognising that we can't have security at home without having security abroad.
Liz Truss didn't get the chance to enjoy any type of honeymoon, as just 2 days after her appointment as Prime Minister, she delivered the single biggest state intervention into the economy since the 2008 financial crisis, with her energy price guarantee, as well as announcing the death of Her Late Majesty Queen Elizabeth II, which we'll look at later on. The wheels quickly fell off for Truss following her decision to challenge Treasury orthodoxy with a tax-cutting, regulation-lifting fiscal plan, the first of its kind for 30 years. The mini-budget went too far, too fast, which spooked the markets and saw the pound slump against the dollar as the press and commentariat slammed her plan. In a firefighting exercise, Truss sacked Kwasi Kwarteng, her chancellor, who was the most qualified holder of that great office of state for decades. She replaced him with technocrat Jeremy Hunt, who helped to orchestrate her removal from office. Like Icarus, Liz Truss flew too close to the sun with her economic plans, and she tendered her resignation to His Majesty the King after a rollercoaster of 49 days in office. She was replaced by her rival over the summer, Rishi Sunak, in a coronation by Conservative MPs. There was no MP ballot, and only Sunak, after close challenges by Truss's predecessor Boris Johnson and Leader of the House of Commons Penny Mordaunt, reached the required number of nominations. In his first speech outside 10 Downing Street, this is what the Prime Minister told the British people.
I've just been to Buckingham Palace and accepted His Majesty the King's invitation to form a government in his name. It is only right to explain why I'm standing here as your new Prime Minister. Right now, our country is facing a profound economic crisis. The aftermath of COVID still lingers. Putin's war in Ukraine has destabilized energy markets and supply chains the world over. I want to pay tribute to my predecessor, Liz Truss. She was not wrong to want to improve growth in this country. It is a noble aim, and I admired her restlessness to create change. But some mistakes were made. Not born of ill will or bad intentions. Quite the opposite, in fact. But mistakes, nonetheless. And I have been elected as leader of my party and your Prime Minister, in part, to fix them. And that work begins immediately.
Politics seems to have returned to a sense of normality since Sunak's appointment. However, the economy is in a precarious position. The tax burden is at its highest rate since 1948. Energy bills are rapidly rising and house prices are soaring. As if 2022 wasn't crazy enough, Tesla CEO Elon Musk bought Twitter for $44 billion and former Health Secretary Matt Hancock controversially joined the cast of I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here and unfathomably managed to come third. A suitably weird way to end a weird political year. 2022 was also a huge royal year, for good reasons and bad. It marked Her Late Majesty Queen Elizabeth II's Platinum Jubilee, which marked 70 years on the throne, an achievement no British monarch had ever reached. Her Late Majesty became the second longest reigning monarch in history, behind the Sun King, Louis XIV of France, who was sovereign for 72 years from 1643 to 1715. However, Platinum Jubilee celebrations were more muted in comparison to those of the Diamond Jubilee just 10 years ago. The royal year got off to a tough start with Prince Andrew, Duke of York, in February, settling his sexual assault court case with Virginia Roberts Dufresne, thus ending his public life. But the Platinum Jubilee weekend was the first big national celebration post-lockdown, and what an event it was. From RAF flypasts and trooping the colour, to street parties and bank holidays, a grateful nation paid tribute to its sovereign lady, and thanked her for her unwavering and steadfast commitment to serving the United Kingdom and the Commonwealth. However, the highlight had to be when Her Late Majesty hosted Paddington Bear for tea at Buckingham Palace. Let's look back on this meeting of two British icons.
Perhaps you would like a marmalade sandwich. I always keep one for emergencies.
So do I. I keep mine in here.
Oh.
For later.
The party is about to start, Your Majesty.
Happy Jubilee, ma'am. And thank you for everything.
That's very kind.
Sadly, on the 8th of September, just 3 months after the Platinum Jubilee celebrations, Elizabeth II died at Balmoral Castle in Scotland, and the United Kingdom, Commonwealth and world mourned the loss of a giant in history, bringing a close to the second Elizabethan era and ushering in the third Carolean era. Tributes flooded in from royalty, presidents and prime ministers from across the globe, and His Majesty the King paid this tribute to his mother.
Throughout her life, Her Majesty the Queen, my beloved mother, was an inspiration, an example to me and to all my family. And we owe her the most heartfelt debt any family could owe to their mother, for her love, affection, guidance, understanding, and example. Queen Elizabeth was a life well lived, a promise with destiny kept, and she is mourned most deeply in her passing. That promise of lifelong service I renew to you all today. Alongside the personal grief that all my family are feeling, we also share with so many of you in the United Kingdom, in all the countries where the Queen was head of state, in the Commonwealth and across the world, a deep sense of gratitude for the more than 70 years in which my mother, as Queen, served the people of so many nations. Thank you. Thank you for your love and devotion to our family and to the family of nations you have served so diligently all these years. May, flights of angels, sing thee to thy rest.
A state funeral was held in her honour, the first since that of Sir Winston Churchill in 1965, and it was a fitting send-off for a dearly beloved queen. Over 250,000 mourners joined the 10-mile queue to see Her Late Majesty's coffin lying in state, in the ancient and august setting of Westminster Hall. The queue was the subject of extensive reporting as it evolved into this kind of organic being and epitomised the great British tradition of lining up. The night before the state funeral, Their Majesties the King and Queen and Their Royal Highnesses the Prince and Princess of Wales hosted a reception at Buckingham Palace for representatives from 168 countries who were attending the service at Westminster Abbey. Guests included 18 monarchs, 55 presidents and 25 prime ministers, making it the largest gathering of world leaders ever held, which is testament to the unifying legacy of Her Late Majesty. The accession of King Charles III ushered in a new era for the monarchy. For the first time in its thousand-year history, the Accession Council, in which the entire Privy Council meets to proclaim the new sovereign, was televised, providing rare access to this most solemn occasion. His Majesty is already pursuing a slimmed-down monarchy, which puts those in the immediate line of succession at the fore. 2023 will see the first coronation of a British monarch for 70 years and is set to be a spectacle. A bank holiday has already been declared for the celebrations and will undoubtedly be a bright spot in what looks set to be a difficult 2023. We're going to go to a quick break, but when we come back, I'll be looking back on some of our most interesting interviews of 2022. We'll be back after this. The first conversation we're going to look back on is going to focus on the biggest story of the year, the Russo-Ukrainian War. The Russian invasion was a brutal onslaught in the early days of the war, and this interview is with Ukraine's youngest ever MP, who took up arms to join the troops defending his country. My guest this week is the youngest member of the Ukrainian Parliament, Sviatoslav Yorosh. Sviatoslav, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for your interest, attention, care. Ukraine, what it faces is an onslaught from more than 1,000 kilometer border with Russia, as well as about 500 kilometer border with its vassal Belarus and landings on the Black Sea. Generally, a full-blown invasion unlike anything since the Second World War. For Europe, that's truly a novelty, but for Mr. Putin, it is not. Mr. Putin is putting to practice what he has talked about for decades in power, that is trying to destroy post-Soviet states and integrate them into Russia. He has spoken about Ukrainian nation at length in different occasions, but the speech he gave a week before the invasion is very clear that he wants to destroy our nation, destroy our statehood, and to integrate it into the Russian state that he is building there. Reality is what he faced since the day of the invasion is a relentless defiance by our people, from everybody in from the government to everyday people that are coming out in droves to join defense forces, the territorial defense units, and fight with everything they've got for the country, the only country they were born with. And the fact of the matter is that fight is giving us chance to show the world that this second biggest army in the world still cannot break a spirit of the country willing to stand up for its independence and integrity. The fact of the matter is we are proving to Mr. Putin that a nation does exist, that a nation wants to fight for its existence and for its right to build its future as it sees fit. As far as the West responds to the reality in question, that is just the fact is that the West is making many of the right moves in two regards. First, isolating Russia from international conferences, forums, platforms, institutions, because Russia over the last two decades has broken every single rule there is to break in the international law book. Mm-hmm. And Russia needs to be punished for that by exclusion from every single forum that it's a part of. It doesn't deserve a place there in any capacity. So the point about the Western efforts in trying to throw Russia off those structures that is very much what we welcome and see as justified, not just because of action in Ukraine. Putin for decades has done plenty to deserve this. Attacks with chemical weapons on the soil of Western nations, manipulation with democracy in Western countries, crises in Asia, in Africa, in Americas that he has fueled, supported, and built up on. As for the question of Western response and support and aid, all is welcome, nothing is enough, and all is needed. The reality is that, again, we are fighting in the second biggest army in the world. We are facing an unprecedented humanitarian disaster for a nation of 40 million that is essentially trying to face off with a tragedy, again, not seen since the Second World War, and to get and try and solve all the humanitarian challenges, not even to start on military challenges of that will take a great deal of effort. So again, we need everything. And again, I keep telling this to my colleagues who attack, you know, tweets and words from the West, like, you know, people praying for Ukraine. We are a God-fearing nation. So for us, even your prayers matter.
Well, thank you very much for that overview of what's going on at the moment and sort of the wider context of what's happening within this conflict. So let's just break some of what you've said down for a moment. So you're in Kyiv at the moment. What's the situation like on the ground in the city right now?
So as far as Kyiv is concerned, in the first week, the Russians have tried to make different incursions to the city. They sometimes got quite far with various troops they had, not because of decoys and manipulation they've used. We had plenty of shootouts, which I had a dubious pleasure of being in these shootouts as well. The reality is that AK-47 that journalists keep telling me about and carrying around is essentially a precaution. It's better to be safe than sorry, as they say. And the question is that after a week of that, we are essentially turning Kyiv into a fortress to stand up to whatever Russians throw at us. And no matter how many people leave, it's a city of millions nevertheless. And if Russians come here in force, they will have their Stalingrad here. This is our capital. This is the place which is fundamental for our nation's existence, for our nation's vision of itself. We shall not give up on it, no matter what. As far as the battle going on, it's the battle all around Kyiv. Russians have tried to use, they have poured through Belarus into the Chernobyl exclusionary zone and taken over the nuclear power station there, causing plenty of issues, problems, and potential catastrophes in the making there, not just for Ukraine or Russia, but for the whole of the world. Nuclear disasters have that tendency, and Russia is causing plenty here in Ukraine now. And they are trying to pour out of Chernobyl into the western outskirts of the city, trying to cut our supply lines to the European Union and to the western border. We aren't letting them. There are fierce battles going on right now. I was in plenty of those battles and visited plenty of those towns. And again, try to both improve my rudimentary skills as a soldier, as well as to provide various different aid, which I can gather from different people that I met through the years and decades of work, various capacities all over Ukraine and the world. So the point here is that with all this, the Battle of Kyiv is ongoing. The battle right now is to keep the city supplied and to break the siege the Russians are trying to wage on the town.
And you mentioned that you've been involved in a shootout or a couple of shootouts, and online on various social media platforms, on news outlets, I've seen images and videos of you walking the streets with what to me I think is an AK-47, or certainly a massive gun. Did you know how to use a gun like that before this conflict started? Because of course you're a politician, you're a member of parliament. So I suppose, how have you adapted to going from being a politician to essentially becoming a soldier?
Well, the reality is my experience was rudimentary at best with a gun, even though I had chances to try and unfortunately to have that experience. But again, now I'm not just by myself. I have plenty of people around me that have good skills with the gun. So I'm trying to ask them for advice and for rudimentary training. And I don't carry AK-47 anymore. I carry AKM-74. And as far as handling that gun, it's not rocket science, as they say. It's essentially something you can pick up and develop, and to develop some skills to try and be useful if the Russians come in force to try and seize the town, to be useful in different capacities, including in those shootouts and the reality of hell that is fighting on the street, fighting in city.
What you're doing is just so incredibly brave, and what the people of Ukraine are doing in taking up arms, not necessarily soldiers, but just ordinary people who 2 weeks ago were just living day-to-day lives. It's incredibly brave. But for you, do you feel that what you're doing is almost your duty as a public servant?
Well, I mean, the fact of the matter is it's the reality of it all. I mean, this is country, the biggest country in the world, which still thinks it needs more land, and it's trying to destroy my country. Mr. Putin has made no question there. He is, again, that hour-long speech, which anybody can watch, is laying this case pretty clearly, and his vision for our country. And the point is that as far as members of parliament and politicians in general, we are citizens first, and we need to try and be a part of that effort in every capacity we can be. So the point here is very much the same, that we are in this effort together with everybody else. And if we are in a town which is besieged and facing street battles and battles for its survival, we have to get those skills to be useful here as well. It's not a battle somewhere far away. It's right here. I mean, I'm sitting and talking with you in a place, you know, basically about 3 kilometers away from 3.5-4 kilometers away from me is where the shootout I spoke about before happened. I mean, they caught Russian saboteurs about 200 meters, 250 meters away from here. And Russian forces, that big column, the 40-kilometer column that is discussed in Western media, is about 30 miles away from here. So at the point here, it's not in somewhere far away. It's right here. So we have to be ready. We have to understand that anything can turn any moment. So we need to prepare ourselves for the worst. And again, I'm not just awaiting that. I'm going to the battle locations around the city. My team, my parliamentary team members are leading different platoons there. I have one team member who went through the worst in the fighting in eastern Ukraine for the last 8 years. He was fighting with the Russians there in one of the most destructive battles that was waged over the last 8 years. He was captured. He was kept by the Russians as a POW for almost half a year. And, you know, he's leading a platoon there. I was coming to him time and time again to get that training to spend some time patrolling with him. And the point is, again, you are everything now because you are required to do everything right now. You have no other choice.
Sviatoslav Yorosh, thank you very much for coming on the show. And please stay safe, and we pray for you and the people of Ukraine. Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much for caring. Thank you very much for taking more than 3 minutes with us. Again, zingers, sound bites are quite annoying after all this time, and having a half an hour interview is very much music to my ears.
Thank you very much. Thank you to Sviatoslav Yorosh for speaking to me back in March. For our next interview, we're going to look even further back, because it was 2022 when the initial investigations for the government's COVID-19 public inquiry began. To coincide with this and the 2-year anniversary of the first lockdown, we held our own lockdown inquiry on the show. And this interview is with a parliamentarian who stood firm in challenging the government's handling of the pandemic and campaigned for the protection of civil liberties throughout lockdown. My guest this week is the Conservative member of the House of Lords and chair of AJ Bell, Baroness Morrissey. Helena, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Nathan. Great to be here.
Well, let's move away from some of the economic stuff and the spring statement, and let's look at lockdown, the COVID restrictions. We've just marked 2 years since that first lockdown happened. Do you think overall the government has done well in tackling COVID-19?
No, I actually think that with hindsight, and if there was a really sort of clear review of everything that had happened and policy decisions taken, it'll look like a very big policy failure or set of policy failures. I completely understand why we locked down 2 years ago. I think we had very little knowledge about the virus. There was a lot of anxiety that it was, you know, universally affect everybody, whatever their age, whatever their health. And it was very scary, I think. And so I could have a lot of sympathy with the government's decision then to lock down and to gather more evidence. But I think as the evidence amounted and it became clear that there were lots of other risks to contend with, as I mentioned already, young people's mental health, school children not being able to go to school, university students not being able to go to university, obviously a lot of other illnesses like cancer and heart disease mounting up undiagnosed, and people suffering economically, then we should have been much more sort of even about assessing the risks. And the second and third lockdowns, I think particularly the third, and all the restrictions since, will prove, I think, if we can ever prove it. So that's a big question mark, of course, but to really not to have been the right approach. But as I say, I mean, I have sympathy with the first step, and I would caution as well, I'm not somebody who I think you should, you know, there's not much benefit from looking back and blaming everybody. And we should be looking forward at this stage and making sure that never happens again, that people's freedoms are not constrained in the same way.
And the first lockdown, it raises quite an interesting idea around what the powers of the Prime Minister and the executive really are. And it's quite a technical point. But in Boris Johnson's televised address, when he announced the lockdown that evening on the 23rd of March, it was only on the 25th of March that the Coronavirus Act, which facilitated that and enabled it, was actually passed. So essentially, we had 2 full days where we were all mandated to stay at home, solely on the word of the Prime Minister and from the government. So do you think that could potentially set quite a dangerous precedent for future governments and future prime ministers, should there, hopefully not, but should there be another major crisis on this scale, which does require an immense expansion of the state and the suspension of many civil liberties?
Well, I'm afraid you're completely, you know, it's an absolute nail on the head with those comments. And that's one of the reasons why I was so concerned about the policy actions taken, because it wasn't just that it didn't go through proper scrutiny in the House of Commons, but these bills, you know, we debated on them. And in fact, I gave my maiden speech on the Coronavirus Act. I think it was in the October of 2020 when it came up for renewal. And it was all after the fact. I mean, there was nothing really that could be done. There wasn't proper parliamentary scrutiny. And I worry that, you know, people have got used globally, not just in the UK, obviously, but to being somewhat, you know, the fear factor that there really was a Project Fear, I think, put in place so that people actually, you know, got used to being told what to do in a way that I think is very dangerous for liberties going forward.
And within this Project Fear, almost, the government used what it calls its Behavioural Insights Team, or a nudge unit, as it's been known, to try and influence the way people are thinking through PR campaigns and messaging services, whatever it may be. But again, following on from this point about setting dangerous precedents, you know, should the state really have the power to essentially control the population's behaviour in such a way?
No, I mean, I think when people vote for a government, they certainly, you know, they know that if there was an emergency, then the government would step up and put some measures in place. But I don't think you can describe something as an emergency when it drags on for 2 years. You know, there's clearly, and given the evidence, I mean, if it had been something like Ebola, where the death rate, the mortality rate is about a third, I understand it, and obviously causes devastating birth defects. And I'm not diminishing, please don't anyone think from listening to me that I'm diminishing the impact of coronavirus on people who obviously suffered losses in their family, or, you know, had terrible things happened, you know, in terms of the impact of long COVID and so forth. So I'm not in any way trying to diminish it, but we did learn that the average age of people who died from COVID was, you know, 82, and younger people tended to have comorbidities, other illnesses. So I think in these circumstances, it's very hard to justify that range of powers that the government frankly bestowed upon itself.
Yeah, absolutely. It does raise some certainly interesting questions. And in this sort of expansion of the states that we had, it also influenced the economy as well, primarily through the coronavirus job retention scheme, or again, furlough, as many of us know it. And again, this is a completely new scheme, but It's quite shocking to hear the Chancellor of the Exchequer say the government will step in and pay people's wages. I mean, certainly from my perspective as someone who's quite a free market believer and thinker, it takes quite a bit to rationalise that the state will pay people's wages. Do you think it did save the many thousands of jobs the Treasury is claiming? Or do you think actually for many people, it simply delayed the inevitable?
Well, I think I understand again why it was done in an emergency. And I think that was probably the sensible thing. If you're going to literally put the shutters down on business and say you can't operate, then, you know, the government has to take the other side of the coin. However, let's remember that the government's money is really our money.
Yeah.
It's taxpayers' money. It's not got some magic, you know, apart from printing it or kind of borrowing it. They haven't got any magic supply. And that's the problem, why it is inevitably a toll on the future and on people's livelihoods in the future, because, you know, that money has to be paid out from somewhere. And so that's why the tax burden is rising. You know, it's not just some sort of magic sleight of hand that you found this extra money. So in the end, we all poorer because the economy was shuttered. It's just that I think, you know, what was right about that was meaning that people who, you know, worked in restaurants and in shops and, you know, that just had absolutely no say in the matter, you know, had the opportunity to get some money and survive during that period, which obviously I think is right. But it's just now because it extended for so long, because the restrictions were so long-winded, then obviously the burden now on everybody is much higher than it would otherwise have been.
Yeah, absolutely. And so just to finish then on a positive note, you mentioned there the restrictions have ended, life's more or less back to normal now, and we're much freer than we were. So looking back over the last 2 years then, do you think there were any good practices or really good ideas that came about because of the pandemic and how we had to adapt to these rapidly changing circumstances that you think actually were really beneficial and we should actually continue with?
So, well, I mentioned earlier, it might seem a relatively small thing compared with all the adverse impacts that we've talked about, but I mentioned earlier, you know, I think a lot of businesses became much more technologically savvy and a lot and did things that would have taken them absolutely years to achieve in days or weeks, particularly at the start. You know, we should have been able to work remotely, even if we should be also working in the office. And I think a lot of things that, you know, I mean, even like the school rooms, I mean, I'm a school governor where they did do very well in terms of the curriculum through the pandemic, and they've preserved quite a lot of things that they learned through that, which actually are very effective teaching and learning tools. So I think there are definitely, those of us who aren't tech experts, you know, we leapt up into the 21st century because we had to. And that's good for the economy, that's good for businesses, that's good for the future. So I think we learned that. I think we did also learn, I saw a lot of examples of people being very compassionate, very kind, very aware of difficulties that people had. I think, you know, as I mentioned, I work in finance where, you know, there's been tend to be a very macho culture, often just for its own sake, if you ask me. You know, people, a lot of bravado about working ridiculous hours and being quite mean to people. You know, I just think now there's an element where people see actually we're all, as I said earlier, human beings with a human side. And we should nurture that and watch out for each other. A lot of my colleagues in different organizations I'm involved with, you know, we said we got to know each other better from seeing each other on Zoom in our homes and seeing a dog walk in or a child walk in or husband walk past or something than we did with sitting next to them for decades in the office. So we learned a bit more about our humanity, and that's a good thing.
I completely agree with that. On one final point then, when the government's COVID-19 inquiry finally gets underway and we start to learn a little bit more about what really went on.
With your breath, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. What do you hope are the main lessons that are learned from it?
So I do hope, I understand it's ruled out that the scope does include young people, because my understanding is the initial scope, which they're consulting on right now, does not. So I hope that they do. But I hope that we learn how to not take that very, very blunt approach to a public health crisis in the future. I hope that we learn never to need to do lockdowns again, and how to balance things and have perspective.
Okay, completely agree with you. And Baroness Morrissey, thank you very much for coming on the show.
It's been my absolute pleasure. Thanks, Nathan.
My thanks to Baroness Morrissey for coming on the show. Free speech has been a huge issue in recent years, and this interview is with a man who has been fighting the good fight for it. He is a comedian turned podcaster who published his book, An Immigrant's Love Letter to the West, in which he makes the case for maintaining Western values. My guest this week is author, comedian, and co-host of the Trigonometry podcast, Constantine Kissin. Constantine, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Nathan.
Thank you. Now, you've just published your first book, An Immigrant's Love Letter to the West. Could you just give listeners an overview of what the book's about and some of the themes discussed within it?
Well, mostly the book is a reminder to people in the West who were born here, who perhaps haven't traveled that widely, who haven't experienced different societies. It's a reminder to all of those people that they're incredibly fortunate to be living in the West in the 21st century, and that some of the problems that we constantly obsess about and spend inordinate amounts of time discussing are actually not that big, not that serious, and by comparison to what people have to deal with around the world, and by comparison to what human beings have always had to deal with in every era of human civilization, we're very, 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 very fortunate. And so, you know, that's the main point of it. I talk a lot in the book about how some of the tendencies of modern Western societies remind me of growing up in the Soviet Union, whether that is the adoption of a very Soviet concept, which is political correctness invented in the Soviet Union to restrict what people could and couldn't say, mainly about communism and the party and so on. This has now been adopted quite uncritically in the West, it seems to me, where we're constantly restricting what other people are allowed to think, what they're allowed to express in public. And of course, many other things that are happening, the growing appeal of far left politics to young people and some of the similarities I find there. And I also offer what I think is, you know, I offer a lot of reasons why the West is good. I warn about some of the directions in which it's heading. And then I'm just making sure that I try to communicate that in a way that people can hear, which is quite important in the times that we're now in, because social media kind of, annihilated any incentive for people to actually be polite to each other. And so, you know, any information that is counter to what you already believe will often be received with extra difficulty because it's perceived as being tinged with, you know, insult and disrespect and so on. So I tried to write it in a way that people could read.
It sounds really interesting. And I just want to pick up on the title of the book. You know, it's an immigrant's love letter to the West. And we have so many different conceptions of what the West is, be it civilization, values, philosophy, but also looking at, say, through geopolitical lenses and like collections of countries, etc. So just with the title then, what do you specifically consider to be the West? Is it that's the values, philosophical style of the West, or do you see it as just that collection of countries within the Western Hemisphere?
Well, this is the difficulty of having called the book what I did, because it actually isn't what I meant. I was primarily really trying to talk about the Anglosphere. That is what I'm talking about, because, look, it's not untrue that all Western countries, what you might consider Western countries, which is essentially the descendant countries of the Western Roman Empire. That's why, for example, New Zealand and Australia are part of the West, and countries next to them like Indonesia aren't, because most of the population of Australia and New Zealand are the descendants of people who themselves were the descendants of the Western Roman Empire. But I think we have seen in the 20th and 19th century that the French and the Germans have very different concepts of how to do these things. And it is actually the Americans who end up taking on the cultural inheritance of the British Empire. So I'm talking about primarily the Anglosphere, which is a certain way of doing business, which is a certain set of laws, a certain set of norms about what isn't acceptable, how free people should be, how far the rights of the individual extend, and so on. That's kind of what I'm talking about. But you're right to pick me up on it, is my point.
Those ideas of the rights of individual freedom, this sort of Enlightenment philosophy that was developed in the Western world and the UK, Europe, you know, those values, and you explore them in more detail in the book, but those values and promoting them. They seem to have gone out of fashion somewhat in recent years. And again, you do pick up on this in this book, but why do you think it is that people seem to be falling out of love with these ideas that have endured for so many centuries?
Yeah, I'm less persuaded that the ideas themselves are falling out of fashion. I think you're right to suggest that promoting them is falling out of fashion. These are two very different things. I think overall, the majority of the public have absolutely no problem with having a common sense approach to most of these issues. I don't think most of the public are obsessed about the issue of transgenderism in either direction. I don't think the majority of the public are obsessed about creating some kind of divide between men and women or, you know, breaking society up along racial lines. I don't think that's what the majority of the public care about, particularly at this moment when they've got gas bills to pay. And, you know, the majority of the public of all sexes and colors and whatever are pretty sensible people in my experience. But as for promoting those values that you're talking about, well, that has fallen very much out of fashion. And that's because the people who largely... I'm going to use the word control, but I want to be clear. I'm not suggesting that this is like a cabal of evil people who've got together and, you know, conspired to capture institutions. Mm. No, they are just the ones, you know, that fill those institutions by and large. You know, the BBC, many of the other mainstream media organizations, the civil service, politics, you know, the entire class of the elite, so-called. Yeah. They are people who've been persuaded by this ideology, particularly because they mostly went to universities where they were all taught some of these ideas, to the point where, you know, you have the Conservative Party supposedly has just pushed through the online harms bill or the online safety bill. And if you analyze it, as my good friend Andrew Doyle has just done, the linguistic significance of that, you literally have the Conservative Party implementing elements of critical theory in government policy, right? So it's not like the evil woke leftists have done this or the evil right wingers have done this. It's the entirety of that elite class, which has completely abandoned any idea that we should be promoting these values, that they should be considered important, that the freedom of the individual actually is quite important. Even if there is a pandemic, that doesn't mean we start taking away people's rights just because we, you know, we're scared. Like, those are some principles. Same with freedom. Yes, we've got a big problem in that we've invented these tools of communication like social media that does allow people to spew hate into your phone unchallenged and uncontrolled. And that's different to what we normally would talk about in the context of free speech, because in the past, nobody could enter your home without your consent significantly, mm-hmm. right? And just start spewing crap towards you. So we have a changing environment, but it seems to me that the instincts of our governing class are not to adhere to those values, whereas the instincts of the majority of the people probably are.
There's a lot of discussion at the moment around free speech and cancel culture, with many describing what this period we're in at the moment as a culture war. Now, do you think that the term culture war is just hyperbole, or do you think we are now finding ourselves in a situation where the values, as we've been discussing earlier, are actually starting to come under attack?
Yeah, I think both of those are true. Those values are coming under attack, and that is the culture war. That's how I would see it. The culture war is a battle between, I mean, the thing is, there's different groups and some are less pleasant and some are more pleasant than others. But at the core of it, the way I see the culture war, forgetting the extremists on both sides who are going at it, is a discussion and a debate over how far we should push the lever of progressivism. You know, how far do we want to throw away traditions and culture and customs and the things that at this point we may no longer even remember why they are the way they are, but maybe the fact that they've endured long enough to forget why they're there is a good reason not to throw them away without at least thinking about it first. Like, that is, to me, the cultural conversation that I'm in, which is, do we, in the desire to continue to make our societies better, which I think most people share, do we go as far as we're being encouraged to, and frankly, as far as we've already gone? Or is it time to maybe step back and go, well, if the most prominent gender transition clinic in this country is being shut down because of thousands of allegations of malpractice, is it possible that maybe in the desire to accommodate everybody's wish to be who they are, maybe we've actually gone slightly ideological about it and we've started hurting children who, by the way, are not capable of making these decisions, but were encouraged to by this particular clinic. Now that clinic is shut down. Thousands of parents and detransitioners are suing that clinic. Is it maybe the case that we've gone a little bit too far on that particular issue? And maybe there's other things, you know, when we have people demanding that we defund the police, is that really the best way to protect people at the bottom of society, to remove the one barrier between them and criminals? Is that maybe if we are defacing the statue of one of the greatest people in the history of this country who saved Britain and helped save Europe and the world from Nazism, we're defacing his statue with the word racist. Is it maybe the case that that is actually not who we want to be as a society, that while we recognize that people who lived 100 years ago were not perfect, they nonetheless maybe did some good and we shouldn't judge them always by the standards of today? Like that's to me the conversation. I think it's an important one. People who want to dismiss this discussion don't understand its significance. Culture, you know, Andrew Breitbart, who was a very controversial journalist in America, but was nonetheless respected in many ways, he said that politics is downstream from culture. And if culture matters as much as that, then it seems to me quite important that we get that right.
Okay, so a very quick final point then. You know, we've just going back to the book, we've discussed the decline of the West and the decline of promoting Western values. So what do you propose then we should do to get us to re-engage with those Western values and really get out of this kind of malaise we find ourselves in today?
I think we've got to realize that we've got big challenges in front of us. Challenges always ignite some people into action. They ignite them into seriousness. So that's what I always say to people who are young people is, you know, if you care about climate change, get in the lab, go and find the solution to climate change. Don't whine about it. Don't try to impoverish poor people who never went to university like you, right? Go and make something of your life. Create, build, make things that are going to make the world better. You know, the unfortunate thing about your generation and mine is we've all been persuaded that, you know, the way to solve the problems of the world is to express how we feel. Well, that isn't how you solve the problems of the world. I hope more and more young people discover that and embrace that.
Okay. Constantine Kissin, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much.
Many thanks to Constantine Kissin for coming on the show. I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this week. I really hope you enjoyed listening to these interviews. And if you want to hear any of the conversations we've featured in full, then simply download the Nathan Eckersley podcast on your favourite podcast platform to find the discussion you want to hear more of, and there are plenty more available. Thank you to Sviatoslav Jurash, Baroness Morrissey, and Constantine Kissin for coming on the show, and thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Eckersley, and I'll be back at the same time, same place, next week. Goodbye.